This podcast is a recording of a webinar held on 4th of November 2020 with the title of We Are an Anti-Racist Organisation. What does this mean? This webinar was full of challenge for all of us, personal, organisational and for our sector.
It's also incredibly timely because I don't know if anyone's feeling quite tired from staying up well too late last night, but you can't help avoiding the context that we're in around racism, where we don't know whether the most racist president that there has been in America, arguably, I read that somewhere, is possibly going to be re-elected. It's still too early to know. But certainly the context of racism is absolutely forefront. We have all watched Black Lives Matter. We have seen the increasing debate and challenge around racism. I was just in a meeting with Carol, who will speak later on, who was saying, actually, for the first time, you can now talk about institutionalized racism without having to kind of explain it and argue that it exists. And yet we know that racism is still alive and well. It's across Scotland and we're only becoming more aware of it. And so it's incredibly timely because of the context that we're in. And it's very timely because for many of us in the charity sector, it is long overdue that we have this discussion. We had a webinar a while ago that some of you may have been at around what it means to be a human rights-based organisation. And one of the things that was said in that is that if we're going to talk about human rights, if we're going to advocate for them, then we need to walk the talk. Our organisations themselves need to be rights-based. It strikes me actually when we're looking at the whole area of anti-racism that actually it's not only that we need to walk the talk, as in our organisations need to reflect that, but actually sometimes we're not even doing the talking, actually. So I think there's loads for us to really get our heads around, and it's extremely timely for our sector, for our organisations, to have this challenge, to listen to the challenge, and then to take action and result. So I'm really glad that you can all join us here today. I am delighted that we have our three speakers, all of whom I can't wait to hear from. So we're going to hear, first of all, from Talat Yaqub, whom I think many of you may know already. And Talat is an independent consultant, a campaigner, and as well as being the senior policy and public affairs consultant at Just Right Scotland. And then we're going to hear from Carol Young, who is a senior policy officer with the Coalition for Racial Equality and Rights, whom, again, I'm sure many of you know of Claire or Carol herself. And lastly, we're going to hear from Lena Biru, who is a committee member of charity So White, and she also leads the anti-racism work at Bond, which is a sectoral body that works around international development and aid. So it's going to be a great session. What I'll do is just hand over to each of you briefly, and then you can take it from there. We will have time for questions at the end. Because there are so many people in this webinar, the questions will just be through the chat box. So feel free to either save them up to the end or put them into the chat box as we go if something arises. If we don't have time to cover them, then we will follow up afterwards. The speaker's contributions will be recorded, so we will email that out to you afterwards, so you can always send it on to colleagues or family members who would be interested. And of course, Zoom etiquette applies. So if you're not muted, we may well mute you. So please just keep muted, especially because of the large number of people in this meeting. Okay, so I hope that all sounds fairly straightforward. Talat, can I hand over to you and welcome you to speak first?
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for that introduction, Mary. Hi, everybody. I'm glad that I've got an opportunity to chat to you all and thank you for the invitation. I'm not going to lie, I'm tired and my soul is a little bit sore, so forgive me. I don't think a lot of people were surprised by how it turns out, but that doesn't mean it's not disappointing as we see results come in. So I'm trying to keep myself together with an ounce of motivation for the day. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what it means to be a proactively anti-racist organisation. These are conversations that have been coming up a lot in organisations, and I've been talking to a lot of organisations about. And the first thing I want to start off with is that a proactively anti-racist organisation, one that has embedded in it genuine anti-racist approach, doesn't exist because of a moment in time. It doesn't happen because of the current election. It doesn't happen because Black Lives Matter has happened now. It's actually been watching the movement happen all along, because it's a movement, not a moment. It's one that has had this type of attitude, this type of culture change embedded within it. And the reason I point that out is that there's too much of a focus on what can we do quickly and right now. And a focus by an organization that is what can we do to respond to the current state of affairs is not a proactively anti-racist organization. It's an organization that is reactive. And what we're looking for is an organization that is deeply embedding, and what I am looking for certainly, is an organization that's deeply embedding this into the normal day-to-day practice. And to do that, that requires regular self-reflection and challenge that I don't quite think that we do in the third sector or we're ready for. Across the third sector, if I'm being completely candid, within equalities and human rights organizations, there is an objectivity bias. There's an assumption that if you work in that space, then you understand what institutionalized racism is. There's an assumption that you're working with that lens. There's an assumption that we're doing it well. And such an assumption means that we can slip up and we can allow the status quo to continue. But actually, if we're going to take this seriously, we have to have a certain level of competence in the anti-racism understanding that we have. And then we have to hold ourselves to account on how we're actually embedding that into our day-to-day activities, into our jobs, our roles, organization strategies, and outputs. And it can't just be an assumption because, hey, we're the third sector, we're the for good sector, we're the equality sector, because that's where you slip into white saviorism. That's where you slip into, we're doing this because we're good. And if what we do is good, then we are good. That's not how it works. We have to challenge ourselves. And that includes me in challenging myself on anti-racism within the South Asian community towards the Black community. There are spaces around colorism that my community and I have to challenge myself on. This is an evolving thing and we have to evolve with it and hold ourselves to account. So it's just a bit of personal, individual and organizational responsibility that's required and a genuine, honest self-reflection across the third sector. Things that I think that we can potentially do in this space is to take a whole organization approach. Too often the response is, let's set up a working group, let's set up a Black minority ethnic, Black Asian minority ethnic group of staff. And what that does is similar to what we do for women within a women's group, is ask those people who are experiencing discrimination and inequality to do more work for free to tackle the discrimination and inequality. And I've been involved in that. I've seen that constantly. What do we do about the well-being and the safeguarding and trauma of the people who are having to explain the racism they experience or having to tackle it within the organization they've experienced it or the sector they've experienced it for free and their emotional labor whilst doing that? So if we're going to actually engage in this, let's put some investment and money behind it and find ways of doing that. And I think that's a question for funders as well, to think about how do you create anti-racism within the third sector and create funding for that work. But it has to be done by everybody. It can't be something that's done for free for those who are experiencing the emotional labor, the hard work, the trauma of racism. And the final thing that I'd say, and I want to be able to hand it over to the panelists, is that we have to look at what co-production, what distribution of power means for our service users, for those people who are engaging in the activities that we might be advocating for. It is very likely that people of color, and if we're doing our work well, we are taking an anti-racism, a genuine anti-racism approach. We understand that poverty, disproportionate levels of poverty, disproportionate for being further away from power and opportunity, it's more likely to exist if you are in communities of color. If that's the case, are we seeing that same level of representation and disproportionate representation in the people that are using our services, people that are telling their stories, people that we are co-producing with? And if we're not, that means that the service that we are potentially providing as a human rights organization, as an equalities organization, an anti-poverty organization, isn't actually doing what we want it to do, because it's not tackling institutionalized racism and opening its doors for those who need it the most. And often we've got to ask ourselves, are we responding to the lowest hanging fruit, or are we actually doing something about the root of the tree to use a very extended metaphor. But that's some of the things that we need to be doing internally and thinking about the space we create and the service users or the advocacy that we do and who actually gets to have part of the pie, do co-production, do general genuine engagement and distribution of power with us when we know it's communities of colour that are disproportionately disadvantaged and yet they're not necessarily the ones using our service, the ones benefiting from where the funding goes in these services, in these support spaces. So just a few thoughts, a lot of thoughts from me.
Thanks so much, Tamas. I feel like there's so much in there that I might have to go and sit down and reflect a lot, actually. Thank you. I'm going to hand over now to Carol, who, as I said, is from CRER and is going to speak for about 10 minutes on her reflections.
Thanks very much, and thanks to HRCS for inviting me to speak today, and thanks very much to Tala as well. That was fantastic. Absolutely nailed it. Not sure how to follow that up, to be honest, but I'll give it a bash. I'm not going to talk about my organisation, the Coalition for Racial Equality and Rights, CRER, today. We have a website. You can find that in your own time. The only thing I did want to mention about the broader work that we do is that we have done a fair bit of work on representation of minority ethnic people in the charity sector, which you can check out separately. I don't want to go into too much detail because I know that Lena's involved in the Charity So White campaign. So just to note, a year ago, we launched an Equality Action Pledge for charities in Scotland, jointly with GCVS, about representation. We've got over 50 signatories to the pledge so far. The website address for that is thepledge.scot if you're interested in finding out about it. You can also access our research on charity trustee ethnicity in Glasgow there. What I want to focus more on is the broader anti-racist work that I personally do with organisations. For the best part of a decade now, I've tried just about every way possible of explaining how an organisation can become anti-racist. If I'd had much success with that, there wouldn't be so much urgency to the conversations we're having now, to be honest. So out of sheer frustration, 4 years ago, I wrote the CRER policy brief in Changing the Race Equality Paradigm, Key Concepts for Public, Social and Organisational Policy. And this was designed to be a kind of manual for mainstreaming anti-racist approaches. What we wanted to achieve there was to tackle some of the barriers to addressing racism within organisations. And each of the chapters of that publication covered a type of approach that organisations could be using to improve what they do. We had a chapter on changing what we mean by racism, about creating better understandings. We had a chapter about gathering evidence and how you use that. One about understanding the normalisation of whiteness and how this contributes to a whole host of racist outcomes. We had one about changing your culture as an organisation. And finally, one on learning the lessons of the past, where we wound up explaining that if you can't see measurable change happening, then you're not achieving anything and you have to ask why. So that kind of reflected the one-to-one work that I do with organisations and trying to get them to embed the right approaches. And all of the approaches set out in that publication, I think, are just as relevant today as they were 4 years ago and probably have more currency now in the post-Black Lives Matter world. But when I think back over the years, I think the single biggest blockage to achieving the kind of change that we were advocating for when we published that has been the denial of institutional racism and the white fragility that underlies that denial. On the surface, at least, that does seem to be shifting a little bit. People are more open to talking about it. But I've yet to see this result in changes in practice, which is the key thing. In practice, what we actually see is a cycle that prevents change. So the presence of institutional racism is denied because white people within the organisation are inclined to get a little bit defensive. So they either deal superficially with individual issues or they find ways to avoid dealing with the issues altogether. So these issues continue unchecked. Organisation continues to have a problem, continues to act defensively, and round we go. The only thing that I think is going to genuinely break that cycle within organisations is if the organisation, i.e. the individuals that comprise the organisation, make a choice to prioritise taking action on race. And only through doing that can an organisation become anti-racist. As Talat says, it has to be proactive. So recently I've been keen to just talk about this cycle directly when I'm asked to run online workshops. I've done so in the past couple of months with Scottish Government, Police Scotland and others. I think that most of these organisations, and this goes for charity sector organisations too, I think they mostly do understand that when an organisation is predominantly white at all levels, decision makers, managers, people who have influence, the organisational culture will be affected by this. But what they don't understand is that it's not inevitable that a largely white institution will have problems in tackling issues around race and racism just because white people are in charge and they happen to be the dominant group in our society. It's not to say that representation isn't absolutely vital, of course it is, but there's a responsibility there that isn't being met. So racism and racial inequality will only be an intractable problem if white people within institutions choose not to fully engage with those issues, not to talk about them and, you know, try and do everything they can to understand and find solutions. And it's white privilege that allows that choice to happen because these issues don't affect the decision makers directly. If we think about Scotland's public sector, where there's a lot of talk about race, but racial inequalities are in some cases actually worsening and specific calls for action are being ignored, I recently argued that what we're seeing there is the manifestation of white privilege on an industrial scale. You know, the impact, it's bad enough when one organisation isn't particularly getting it right. Multiply that by all the organisations, charity and public sector, and we have a real problem on our hands that we all have a responsibility to try and take on. So after years of talking about what you could do with procedures and practices, I've come to the conclusion, to be honest, that individual choices and behaviours are the sticking point here, because all the paperwork in the world will not make an organisation anti-racist. People have to do that. So now I'm doing more and more sessions where we actually talk about organisational culture very frankly and look at what needs to happen to change that. And for the most part, I'm addressing white people like myself when I'm doing these sessions. And what I ask them to do is think about how they can personally put anti-racism into practice in the workplace. So I ask them very practical things. I ask them to support anyone within the organisation who wants to speak out about racism or inequality. I ask leaders to make space for this to happen. And I ask them that when something needs to be resolved, they need to put aside all concerns about organisational image or personal defensiveness and just take things on board. I ask them to recognise that every time someone tries to deflect a conversation about race, they're prioritising their own feelings in that moment over the long-term damage caused by racism. And once people start to, you know, take on these big questions about defensiveness within the organisation, we can start making real progress. I ask people to speak out if they can see some agenda within the organisation where race isn't, you know, being talked about. If they know there are inequalities that aren't being talked about or dealt with, you be the one to raise it. Don't wait for the equality person in the organisation to raise it, if indeed it has an equality person. I ask them on a personal level with colleagues to do something. Always challenge the concept of tokenism. You know, let's be very frank here, black and minority ethnic people are entitled to be bad at their jobs just the same as white people are. You know, white people get promoted to positions that they can't really handle all the time, but no one ever says it's because of tokenism. In actual fact, we can see from interview data that you're more likely to be appointed to a post if you're white against someone who's got the same qualifications as you. So actually, in some ways you could say it is tokenism. But in any case, ask them to speak up for colleagues. Make sure they get the credit they deserve for the things they work on. Make sure that they get given the good projects to work on that they deserve. Speak up and say if you think they deserve that job, because it's the fact that people are overlooked constantly in the workplace that has such a bad effect on their career. And it's partly to do with a cycle where people become both over-scrutinised and undervalued in the workforce. And we have plenty of evidence on this, which I could go into detail about, but I've only got 5 to 10 minutes, so I won't. But essentially just to recognise that your colleagues are not able to fly under this cloak of invisibility of supposed normality that white privilege brings. So we need to keep an eye out for each other, essentially, and stop the kind of attitudes and structures behind racism from affecting people's working lives. And when I talk about racial scrutiny in the workplace, I'm very clear that this has a gendered aspect as well. And it's not a matter of hidden bias, it's a function of institutional racism. When Lord McPherson talked about that in his report into the Stephen Lawrence murder inquiry, he He acknowledged that simple thoughtlessness or ignorance on the part of individuals within an organisation becomes a collective failure that disadvantages minority ethnic people. And this is something we can all guard against by ensuring that we don't act thoughtlessly, we'll learn more and we'll encourage others to do the same. But it will not happen by magic. We need to make the choice to prioritise it through becoming actively anti-racist. And put simply, to become an anti-racist organisation, we need enough of us to commit to becoming anti-racist individuals first. Thanks. I'm going to hand back now.
Thanks so much, Carol. Again, there's so much challenge there, especially about that, where the personal links up to the institutional and our personal obligations, responsibilities that we really need to reflect on and act on. Thank you. And lastly, I want to welcome Lena Biru from charity So White, who's also going to speak to us for about 10 minutes. And a reminder, we'll have questions after that. Lena.
Hi, thanks very much for inviting me to be part of this session. It's wonderful to hear Talat and Carol speak, and I agree with so much of what they have said already. Just to tell you a little bit about Charity So White, in case you aren't aware, we are a campaign. We're a movement that seeks to root out racism in the charity sector in the UK. And more than that, we want the charity sector to lead that change. We believe in the sector. We are run by volunteers. All of us have a day job, and we do this on top because we are passionate about the sector that we chose to work in. And we want it to be better. Quite frankly, it's not good enough. What is going on at the moment? I also lead the anti-racism work at Bond, which is specifically focused on international development and aid there as well. You know, this year has been a year of change and it's still going on. Charity So White, the work that we do there has been exhausting and we are all feeling it a lot right now. Not only with COVID, not only with the Black Lives Matter movement, the resurgence of that. We wrote a position paper talking about the disproportionate impact that COVID-19 were having on the BAME community, which we hope the government will now take into account as we look to go into lockdown number two. We also asked funders to ring fence funding specifically for BAME-led organisations because we understood that those who are best place to support marginalised communities are the BAME-led communities, people who are part of those communities. And funders giving money, as they usually do, to the white-led larger organisations will not get us anywhere in terms of supporting the most marginalised communities. We had some successes in those things, but since the brutal murder of George Floyd, we were inundated with organisations, CEOs, funders asking us the most basic of things: how to redo recruitment, how to talk about racism, how to understand it. And it got to the point where we chose to step back. Obviously, we are seen as leaders and the guard dogs of the sector, and we take that role seriously. But we also knew that we can't keep going and burn out. And this is not just for us, this is every single person of colour in the sector. I don't know anybody who has not been affected by what has happened this summer. You know, the impression of people of colour in this country certainly runs deep through our society, and it's embedded in many of our institutions, in our structures that govern our country, in academic institutions, through the law, prison system, the charity sector, you know, the private sector. This is something that we unconsciously, people of colour, have to deal with every single day. And one of the things that we have seen, and certainly my work in Charity So White and Bond, we've been talking a lot to people of colour and how they are feeling at the moment, and just echoing what Talat has said already, it's exhaustion, it's complete exhaustion. It's being that one person of colour in organisations where your organisation is looking to you to solve things and to put into place an equality, diversity and inclusion practice or strategy. It's being met with a lot of white fragility and defensiveness from white people, from white leaders and from white colleagues. It's being blocked by senior management teams and many organisations who have developed equality, diversity and inclusion strategies, who have brought in consultants, this general feeling about that is that it is performative. We haven't seen enough commitment from any organisations. I get asked this question a lot. What organisation is doing this well? And I really can't tell you one. There are lots of intentions put out there. There are lots of messages of solidarity. But is there real change happening? Unfortunately, we haven't seen it. We haven't seen it enough yet. We haven't seen it. What we would like to see, bigger change, we haven't seen that yet. And it's not that we are demanding something that is impossible. We're not. We are demanding equal rights. To be able to live and work in an environment where you are not discriminated against is a human right. And it is not out of the ordinary to ask for that and to demand it and expect it from organizations and from the people that we work with. Things are particularly hard, I know, for people of color in smaller organizations who are the only one and who have to shoulder that burden. They feel like they have to shoulder that burden. And there is too much siloed thinking going on across the third sector. There is definitely a lot more that we can do instead of just looking at our own organizations, but also across the sector and working together to drive change. One of the things that we do in Charity So White is we don't talk about diversity and inclusion, we talk about power and privilege. And we do that because too often talking about diversity and inclusion can become a shield and an excuse not to engage with the real issues. We know what's going on, and it is just power and privilege. So we should start talking in that way. We shouldn't be scared of talking about it like this. Only when we start to create cultures in our organizations where people feel like they can be honest about their experiences and be heard will change happen. And that is something that is a much wider piece in terms of cultural shift that needs to happen in organizations. We need to be able to talk about power and privilege in a real matter-of-fact way. We know, if we stand back, we know who holds power in our organizations. We know who makes the decisions. We know who gets called in to speak to funders and donors and speak to government and speak to other CEOs. We know who sets the strategy. We know this stuff. We just don't talk about it. And we also know who isn't in those rooms and who isn't at that decision-making table. A lot of people talk about making tables bigger. And I would challenge that and say, actually, no, it's not about making tables bigger for decision-making. It's about you moving. It's about you giving up your seat and bringing in a person of color, bringing in a black or brown person who has lived experience, who has potential, who wants to get involved, whose voice needs to be heard. And the biggest thing for me about the third sector is so interesting is that we all come to the sector because we feel like we are do-gooders. We really are driven by the mission. We are a good person because we are in the third sector. We are helping people. And so obviously being a do-gooder means that we can't be racist. We can't be unequal. We can't be being actively racist in an overt or covert way, because that's not just us. It isn't something that we have fully accepted within ourselves as human beings, that we are flawed. We are flawed. And we all live in the real world. We have all done harm to each other, and we have all been wounded by each other. That is just fact. But we don't talk in these ways, and we really, really should. I want to encourage everybody on this call to start having these conversations in an open way. I also want to talk about, as well as power and privilege, is trauma. And I just have lots of questions, really. Do you know what's going on in your own organization? Do you know how people of color feel in your organization? Have you asked them? Have you created spaces where they feel like they can tell you how they are experiencing the organization? Have you asked your communities that you work with how they experience your services? Have you asked what more you could do? Have you asked about what their experiences have been? Do you understand what trauma means? Do you understand how your actions impact people of color and how that impacts and just adds layer upon layer upon layer of trauma that people of color have to deal with every single day? At the moment, during COVID-19, during lockdown, there's a lot of talk about mental health and well-being, and we really need to start talking openly and honestly about trauma as well. Being a person of color today of all days is extremely difficult. And this is very much tied to that exhaustion that we feel of having the burden placed on us to teach and to guide and to tell you how to not be racist. When actually, Google it. This is something that we've we are doing within Charity So White. But equally, the more I talk to people and organisations, I do just say to them, if you want to know how to become actively anti-racist, there are hundreds of books out there. There are hundreds of webinars out there. Take the power that you have, focus it in a positive way, move to allyship, learn about what you can do. Don't just be held by, okay, let's do a tick box exercise and let's just do solidarity statement now and in a year's time, nothing will be done. As Talit said, this is not about a moment. This is not just about 2020. It's about people demanding and expecting more of society, not just the third sector. This is something that is entrenched in our British society, in the UK society, and it harks back to colonialism, of course. And when we talk about In Charity So White and In Bond about anti-racism, people often want to move to action too quickly without understanding what it really means. Do you understand what racism looks like? Do you understand that it's not just racial slurs? That it's not just mistaking one person of colour for another? That it comes out in different ways? That it comes out in your actions making us doubt ourselves and making us feel like we are not valuable and we are not worthy? Do you understand the extent to which racism comes out in society? I would urge you to go and look it up because all of this information exists on the internet. And I also, you know, there's lots of more TV shows and books and conversations talking about the colonial legacy of the British Empire. And again, if you don't understand already about the structures that we are existing and functioning in and why it is the way it is, go and learn because all of that stuff exists. And we really need to understand from the very basic point the theory of this. We need to understand racism and why it is perpetuating stereotypes that exist already, the harm that it can do, and we need to understand how this country was built. Because this is what we're still living in, and this is what we're still seeing the after effects of, and what people of colour are still facing trauma with. This has got such a deep historical root. And in the last year, we've obviously seen, I really hope, a turning of the tide where it's not just black and brown people who are demanding change, it's also white allies as well. But it needs not be performative. You need to move to active allyship, and it's a daily practice. This is a lifelong journey. This is not just about getting one day right or one month right. You know, we've just had Black History Month in the UK in October, and I've had so many conversations with my colleagues about the fact that they are black all year round. It's not just one month. And this is something that we need to start talking about more and owning. You know, I heard, and I've said this before, Rennie Edo-Lodge, who wrote Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, she put it really well. She talked about racism and power and privilege like this. It's like a staircase that you can walk up. You did not build the staircase, but you do have the privilege of your legs to walk up it. And if you get to the top and you are not advocating for people who cannot walk up the stairs, if you're not advocating for a way to get them to your level, then you are complicit in all of this. Because white people sometimes say to me, but I, you know, this is the sins of my fathers. Actually, no, you're being complicit if you're not actively being an ally. And it is on you. The burden should be on you. Something else that we've been speaking about a lot is, as a young person, you know, when your children in this country, you do not, as a person of colour, get an option to opt out of learning about racism. That's just not how our lives go. There comes a point, and for me it was when I was 5 years old, there comes a point when your parents have to sit you down and tell you, you will be treated differently, and this is why you need to work twice as hard, and you need to make sure that you're professional all the time, and you need to make sure that you're polite and not seen or perceived as aggressive or angry. So many checks need to be put onto us, and we get this ingrained in us as children, as very young children. And I asked you, have you spoken to your children, to your white children, about race? Have you educated them on it? Children are never too young to learn about racism, and they need to, because they take up space in this world as well. And that's something that we've been talking about a lot more, because education is where it starts, with children. They are the ones who are going to inherit everything that's happening in the world now. And we hope that they will be better educated to understand the system that they are working in, to support and make way for people of colour, because we need to have a voice. And it's been too long that we haven't been at the table. It's been too long that we haven't had an empty seat for us. There are so many reasons that we get, so many excuses that we get specifically about the types of people that work in our organisations or who we choose to work with. There are just no one interested out there. There's like not enough people. There's not enough candidates. Actually, there is. We know this as a fact. But one of the biggest things that people don't take into account when they're recruiting for new roles is potential. It's potential of a role. It's potential of a person of colour who may not be a manager, but could have just been a coordinator and have the potential to move into a role of a manager. And that right there is exactly how inequality comes out between white people and people of colour, because we don't have the same opportunities to progress. We don't get that potential recognised. So therefore, we have to encourage people to start thinking and taking seriously a different route for their recruitment and think about potential in organisations and think about your value. Go back to your values as an organisation. Are you living them? Are you actually in the set to do good? Are you living it? Just talking, you know, hearing from the speakers about what they said, are you talking the talk? Are you actively doing that? Because if you were, you would change the way that you work. And that ultimately is what it is. It's about changing the structure that we work in. And I'm not really sure how quickly people are going to start to adopt that kind of thinking. The structure that we work in, the hierarchy that we work in, continues to make sure that people of colour's voices are excluded, who are seen less than. When are we going to start changing those things? I know I've had spoken for a while and I've given you lots of questions, but yeah, I'll stop now.
Thanks so much, Lena. There's so many hugely strong and useful points in there, particularly that core message about it is about power and privilege. So I really appreciate that. There are a few questions coming up in the chat box, so I'm going to fire them at you. So we've got about 20 minutes left, so I might just direct questions to each speaker that I think might respond, if that's okay. So first of all, one around from Ken, who I know is based in Lewis. What is your view on respectable racism? Is there such a thing? What is it? Why should we be concerned about that? Alex, do you want to come in?
I saw that pop up and I don't know what it is. Just being completely honest, I don't know what it is, because I don't know any shape of respectable racism. And I wonder if it's, and you can please feel free to put into chat the definition that you have in your head. And I'm wondering if it means the covert racism, what's happening quietly in the background, what is acceptable, things that are said that are covertly racist in terms of a person just not being ready for the job, or when somebody says someone's not the right fit, I always question what that means. I don't think there is a form of respectable racism, so I'm afraid I can't give a very good answer to that, because I don't know what respectable racism would be.
I'm not sure either, so that's grand. And you can put it in the chat box if you can. Carol, I was wondering if I'd come to you that with one of the comments I'm going to create into a question. So Scotland, sometimes we are thinking that we are brilliant, you know, we're kinder, nicer, sort of soft and cuddly sort of thing. And there's that kind of dynamic with Black Lives Matter particularly that is, at least initially, it seemed to come happening in America and then sort of touching the UK and then, oh, and so. So I just wondered, so racism, Scotland, is there anything different about it? Is it totally the same and we should face up?
I think there's definitely a lot of facing up to be done, yeah. And Scottish exceptionalism, it's a thing. We do try and compare ourselves. Usually, you know, we're comparing ourselves favourably to either England or America. But at the end of the day, we've got a lot to account for. And there's really no point in comparing apples and oranges, to be honest. I think what we do need to remember is that the first race riots in Glasgow happened in 1919. During which the people being attacked were arrested and charged by police, despite one of them having been stabbed, whilst the couple of white sailors who had been injured got taken to hospital, and none of the perpetrators were ever charged, but the victims were. That's the first incident I can think of where you can show that actually we've had many of the same problems. I think that certainly we have less high profile incidents, but we are a small country. It's not even so much about the size of the minority ethnic population, which is growing, but maybe hasn't been giant before. But even despite the fact that we perhaps at one stage had a lower minority ethnic population, there have been incidents to do with race relations right throughout Scotland's history. That you can read a great many great articles about it, the different anti-racist movements that have come and gone in Scotland, dealing with the real problems that affect people's lives. Because to be honest, the high profile stuff, your police brutality, etc., it's horrifying, but it's the tip of the iceberg, you know. Even things like verbal abuse, and I think this comes back to, I suspect, what Ken was driving at earlier when he talked about acceptable racism, was this concept that there's a kind of last bastion of acceptable racism against white minority ethnic groups. I think he did mention Gypsy Travellers in the chat. Certainly, we see a lot of xenophobia, we see zygonism, we see very specific types of discrimination, but it's a total red herring to say that these are some sort of acceptable racism. That's something that's said to drive a wedge between people who are marginalised. But what we do have to remember is that the way that prejudice comes out against people who haven't been racialised is very different, and it doesn't have an intergenerational aspect. One could argue that Scottish Gypsy Travellers have been racialised, Ashkenazi Jews as well. You could argue definitely they've been racialised. It's the rare example of a group that looks white but has faced many of the same things. At the end of the day, though, they can still walk out the house and walk down the street past strangers without anyone knowing what the background is. So, you know, I think as people, you know, groups of people who have been marginalised can't allow, you know, the white majority ethnic group to say what is acceptable and what's not acceptable. And very much in Scotland, we try to claim that racism isn't acceptable, and folk who will tell you about the last acceptable forms of racism, you know, are slightly buying into that myth because they're trying to say that all racism is unacceptable in Scotland, where it just isn't. I think that's my general view. And if you're interested in the specific Scottish context, do pick up a book called No Problem Here, edited by Neil Davidson and others. Not just saying that because I've got a chapter in it, full disclosure, but that will tell you all about the false Scottish exceptionalism around race.
Thanks, Carol. And actually, I meant to say, well, also the report that you mentioned in your contribution earlier, we'll send the links out to those as well. Mina, I was wondering if you could come to you with a question around, because you touched on this, about what do funders then need to do? What needs to shift in relation to funding of the sector and race?
Funding needs to go to more POC-led, BAME-led, however you want to call it, led organisations, and they're usually the smaller ones. It needs to go there because those are the ones who are closer to the most marginalised communities who need support. Larger organisations that are white-led, that have a huge amount of people in them, that have lots of bureaucracy, they do have a place in the world. But are they effective and quick enough and agile enough to be able to respond, particularly in COVID-19? One of the things that we saw was the response of charities in the UK responding to ethnic minorities. And because of barriers, because of language barriers, because of multiple issues, they don't connect and they are not trusted. Marginalised communities don't trust the larger ones. This is the assumptions that are made in the charity sector at the moment. But truth be told, how are you going to best support a marginalised community if you don't understand them? If you don't understand them and if you don't understand the intersectionality that they face? Definitely when we talk about racism, when we talk about anti-racism, we need to be looking and talking about it through an intersectional lens. It is not just one fits all. Even with ethnic minorities, even with racialized communities, and we have to be as specific as possible to be as effective as possible to be able to support them. And that type of support comes from BAME-led organizations. The funding needs to go there, but what does happen with funders is that they fund a certain way because they always have. Much like many things that happen in this country, they just always have worked that way, so they continue to, which speaks to the structures of what we're operating in at the moment. And it's got to be a shift in thinking with funders. We have certainly seen that with Comic Relief and the COVID response. fund that they created, they didn't give the money out to organisations. They looked for BAME-led intermediaries to give that money out to community-led organisations. That is an interesting turn that they took, and they're committed to it, and they are doing it again now with their Global Majority Fund that they have just announced yesterday. So change is happening. But interestingly, I have spoken to many funders, and they have told me, you know, they've said to me, Lena, the third sector, they think that the sector think that they can ask funders to hold them accountable, but we have our own problems. And that was just being an honest, direct conversation. That was just being honest, and I really appreciated that. Funders themselves need to sort themselves out. There is too much hierarchy. There is too much power and privilege going on that is perpetuating the system, even within funders. But, you know, we have to start where we are. We are in the third sector. We have to start with ourselves. We have to start by working across the sector. And maybe that is how we can come together and hold our own power and then go to funders and demand change that way. But change, you know, has to start with us. And we have more power than we let on, really.
Thanks, Lena. There's a few questions that all touch on intersectionality and to what extent organisations trying to change and trying to be anti-racist and having the space and understanding and taking action that need to take intersectional approach. Talat, do you want to respond to that?
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to be honest in that intersectionality really runs a risk of going the same way mainstreaming diversity and inclusion did, as words that are diluted and lost in the system, right? Because it's a thing that the sector particularly and policymakers in Scotland are noted to use. But actually, you've got to learn what it means, and you've got to do it, you've got to deliver it. And there's a responsibility there. So just intersectionality is about an appreciation of, an understanding of, and an analysis of inequalities that pursues change based on the understanding that people will experience multiple and compounding discriminations at the same time. So I don't get to park the fact that I'm a woman and only experience racism as somebody who is South Asian and forget Islamophobia today because today I'm not Muslim. I am all these things at the same time, which means that I can experience gendered racism, Islamophobic sexism, gender racist sexism, whatever it might be. So, for example, the specific Islamophobia that a hijab-wearing woman might experience, the specific sexism or the tropes about angry black women that a black woman might experience. That's what we're talking about here. And it's really important that we competently tackle that, because it goes back to the lowest hanging fruit. Who are we creating change for? Are we just doing the minimum to change it for the person that's the easiest to change it for? So am I going to aim for middle-class white women whilst I talk about anti-sexism? Actually, a lot of feminism does that. Am I going to talk about a better Scotland for middle-class South Asian men? And that's why we've got only, there's been four MSPs of colour in the Scottish Parliament. They've all been South Asian men. There's something to unpick there about the realities for women of colour, right? So if you're going to do anti-racism well, it has got to be well-informed on class, it's got to be well-informed on feminism, it's got to be well-informed on ableism. And the reason to do that is because you've got to think about the person furthest away from access to opportunity, power, who is experiencing discrimination. And if you can think about the person furthest away and work yourself back to what your organisation should look like, it's going to pick up everybody else along the way, because you're looking at the person experiencing the most inaccessible experience, the person experiencing the most discrimination. So a competent anti-racist approach is an intersectional anti-racist approach. A competent anti-sexism approach, feminist approach, is an intersectional one. And I think that's something that we need to do better, that we need to understand better. And the way to do that is by embedding it into policymaking, embedding it into accountability, embedding it into our practice and how we work, and what expectation of continuing professional development and learning and evolving we expect of the staff and the people who get to work in the third sector. We have to constantly be reaching for them to be learning more. And I mean that, like, I've been in it for 13 years. I've got things that I need to learn, and I need to accept that and challenge myself. You know, it doesn't matter if you're the chief exec who's been there for 40 years, all the more reason, in fact, if you're the chief exec that's been there for 40 years. But you have to relearn and be willing to relearn an intersectionality and understanding compounding inequalities that are happening at the same time with an experience that you might not know anything about is part of that learning you need to challenge yourself about.
Thanks, Talat. And some of what you were saying there really mirrors what Tressa Burke from Glasgow Disability Alliance was speaking at a previous webinar when she was talking about creating these uncomfortable spaces as well to continue to be challenged as to who you're listening to, who you're working for. I'm aware we've just got a few minutes left. There's been a couple of quite kind of practical questions from organisations, I think, who seem to be overly white or all white, and they don't want to be. And on a very practical note, what they do. But I think in some ways, all three speakers have already touched on a lot of the response to that. A lot of it is about culture, and it's about space and understanding and listening and removing yourself from the table and all of these things. Just wondered if any of the speakers want to come back in these last few minutes on anything kind of very practical that organisations in those sort of places can do. What should they be doing? They are struggling with these very practical questions. Carol, I might pick on you.
I think that, you know, if you're a white-led organisation and you've recognised you've got some challenges, then have an invisible prize, because an awful lot still haven't realised they've got challenges. And I can guarantee, if you're an all-white organisation or almost all-white organisation, that's your challenge right there already. So I would say that this is work for all organisations. Even organisations that are relatively more diverse need to do better at this kind of thing. And I think that, you know, one of the questions in the chat related to the need to consider things around about intersectionality when we're considering, you know, do we need to consider policies and procedures and practices when we think about that? Absolutely. But you actually need to flip that around. Whilst there's value in setting out to say we're going to do a programme of work that's about anti-racism, it's actually more powerful to say we're revamping our maternity policies, let's make them anti-racist. You know, so you're actually looking for a situation where what you're doing is everything you're doing in your organisation, service planning, applying for funding, you know, your own internal staff policies, policies related to service users, all of that should have a perspective that's looking at how this will impact minority ethnic people, which will be different, potentially depending on what you're doing, for people from different minority ethnic groups. We're not talking about a homogenous group of people who all have the same needs and views, and that counts between ethnicities, across genders, and the whole range of other forms of intersectionality that you could talk about. Although personally, I still think that the original definition of intersectionality that's talking about the intersection between race and sex is the most relevant one, because it's about those tropes, which I think there's cross-cutting forms of inequality that affect you, maybe because you've got more than one protected characteristic. That's not quite the same thing as intersectionality. Still, to go back to my original point, I think educating yourself and doing the work, not looking for other people to come educate you, but doing the work to find out how different issues affect people. There's mountains of research out there on the employment experience of Black and minority ethnic people, for instance. Read some of that if you're revamping your employment policies. You know, I think it's about taking the responsibility to learn and to listen and to apply what you learn to your policy making.
Thanks, Carol. And so our time is almost up. I'm not actually going to attempt to summarise or highlight any of that, because I think there's so much in there that I can't thank you enough, Talat, Lena and Carol, for your contributions. I think it's been really thought-provoking and challenging. And I absolutely hear that core challenge that we cannot just sit about and think about this and talk about it, but it requires personal and organisational change. So that is the challenge that's left for all of us. And I also recognise, again, and your point about just exhaustion. So particularly in light of that, then I really do thank you for taking part today. As I said before, we have been recording the session and we'll email it to you. So if you want to use this discussion to help provoke a discussion within your organisation, for example, or you want to listen again to take on board some of those key points, you'll be able to do that. Thank you to everyone who's been here today and for all your questions. and I hope the rest of your day is good. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.